JSB and PA welcome you to another LNL, and tonight I'm going to spend the entire hour chatting to HB, the extraordinary writer and critic Harold Bloom. I spent an hour with Harold in his very posh house in Washington Square in New York a week or so ago. It's not the first time we've spoken, but it was great to be with him. He's an immense man, and he sort of draped himself over a huge couch and chatted away very amiably whilst the Hare Krishna raged outside the window. Harold was born in 1930 to a Yiddish-speaking family in the Bronx in New York. He didn't speak English until he was six, and says that he taught himself to read English, which is why he thinks his pronunciation is a little strange. He's been teaching at Yale for 40 years, where he's Sterling Professor of Humanities, as well as Berg Professor of English at New York University. Now, Harold Bloom has written at least 20 books. He's written the introduction, would you believe, to another 500. His most famous work, The Anxiety of Influence, was published in 73, but most recently he's been associated with William Shakespeare in his book Shakespeare, The Invention of the Human. He argues that Shakespeare has made us see and think what we couldn't have thought without him. This is because Shakespeare invented us. Well, as we began our chat, I ran a Shakespearean quote past him, and although he claims to have memorised the entire works of Shakespeare, he was unfamiliar with it. Let the sky rain potatoes, let it thunder to the tune of Greensleeves. I'm sitting here in the apartment of Harold Bloom. Harold, is it true that you know all Shakespeare's plays by heart?
Yes, I think so. But I've never before heard the grand trope of the sky raining potatoes.
It's one of his. It's one of his.
Somewhere in Shakespeare.
From Midsummer Night's Dream.
In the Midsummer Night's Dream. Well, you see, I am hoist.
Well, it's certainly Shakespeare.
Sky rain potatoes.
I know this because I was briefly a Shakespearean actor, and it was in a speech I had to deliver.
Well, you look rather like a Shakespearean actor. But I cannot at this moment, though I stand corrected, I cannot recall the particular trope of the sky raining potatoes.
I always thought it was a wonderful image, which
is why it
lingered in the mind, really.
It's a marvellous image, but I confess, I think it's new to me. But, you know, I'm getting old and my memory is fading.
And Milton, can you also, from memory?
Yes, I can pretty well. I can pretty well work my way through Milton. Though there, too, memory does strange tricks as you age.
I've got a proposition to put to you. I've worked out a way you and I, together, can make an immense amount of money.
Yes.
Now, this is
said
not
he suspiciously.
This is not an unattractive thing. I think.
But is it legal?
It's entirely legal. We're in a country where people invent religions, as you know, on almost an hourly basis.
The United States.
The United States. I've always believed that you could argue that Shakespeare was the Messiah.
Oh, you have no quarrel with me. I've gone even further in my book, you know, and said he's God.
Well, you see, why don't we sort of commercialise this? What we need to do is to find a missing text which links him in some way to the biblical text, because everything's in Shakespeare, isn't it? Everything we could possibly need.
Yes,
is
but
there.
He is very evasive on the question of religion, as you know. He didn't care to get caught up in the Catholic versus Protestant, shall we say, murderous argument.
No, I wasn't suggesting that he was particularly lucid on matters of theology, but anything that we seek to discover, anything we want to know about ourselves as human beings, we can pretty well find in the plays, can't we?
Oh, that is the Bloomian gospel, yes, that it is all there. In fact, if it's not there, it's probably not worth looking for.
Well, Hamlet, you see, there are as many Hamlets, aren't there, as there are Jesus Christ's. Every era, everyone has their own Hamlet.
Well, every intellectual's Christ is certainly Hamlet. There is no question about that.
He was very serviceable, for example, for the existentialist, wasn't he?
He was immensely serviceable for the ancestor of the existentialist, Kierkegaard, who, being from Copenhagen in any case, was able to totally identify himself with the melancholy Dane before him.
And yet here's a guy who, as far as we know, was an autodidact, pretty much entirely self-educated.
The mystery of how Shakespeare got to be Shakespeare is insoluble. Here is someone who must have known better how to read everything that he read than anybody before or since. It wasn't the quantity of the reading. It was certainly to some extent the quality of the reading. But it was the manner or mode of the reading which is utterly fascinating, and which I've never seen, I must say, even begin to be studied. I mean, the extraordinary things that Shakespeare does with the Book of Common Prayer when he chooses to do anything with it, the startling way that he uses biblical allusion, usually in a left-handed way, and in a way that couldn't possibly reinforce, you know, faith or doctrine of any kind. The quite beautiful way he laps up his Chaucer, converting it always to his own purposes, or the most astonishing act of ingestion of all, the enormous swallowing up, as a whale might swallow up a minnow, of his undoubted, I won't say friend, but undoubted for a time, at least companion, they must have known one another, Christopher Marlowe. I think Marlowe caused him a certain indigestion, which you can find in the early plays, but eventually it all went down quite smoothly.
Do many of the the fine writers of whom you approve acknowledge a debt to Shakespeare? Is it sometimes conscious, or is it usually just osmosis?
I think that as writers have been most powerful, they have resented it. Tolstoy hated Shakespeare with enormous ferocity. Dostoevsky adored Shakespeare and acknowledged, not generously but accurately, his debt for Svidrigailov and Stavrogin to Iago and to Edmund in King Lear. You know, if you are going to do nihilists, you go to Shakespeare first. I suppose, and of course figures like Victor Hugo was simply intoxicated by Shakespeare and very glad to proclaim it as he did in his book. The complex problems are people like Goethe, who in the second part of Faust simply rewrites Hamlet, but who keeps protesting that he can do it better than Shakespeare, and finally writes a marvelous essay called Shakespeare und keine Ende, you know, Shakespeare and there is no end to it, there's no conclusion to it, saying it isn't really so, that you can't possibly hope to match Shakespeare. And then there are the fascinating cases like Milton, who writes an equivocal early sonnet commending Shakespeare, but then is really in a rather embarrassing relation to Shakespeare because Satan owes entirely too much to
Iago.
Yeah. In general, there's hardly a moment in Milton that Shakespeare does not haunt, even when Milton is clearly doing his best to evade it.
You also argue that Shakespeare prefigures Freud.
Oh, that's a shocking relationship. Freud not only, and I say this as a great admirer of Freud, I am not one of the Freud bashers, you know, of the Fred Cruz variety who sort of march around the American landscape these days, proclaiming that our great Uncle Siggy was a charlatan. Uncle Siggy was indeed what he called himself, a conquistador. And even though I don't think it comes to anything as so-called positive science, which he pretended it was, I mean, to be the Montaigne of the 20th century, to be the greatest literary essayist in any language, any Western language of the 20th century, is an astonishing distinction. But on Shakespeare, Freud was equivocal, and I think you would have to say dishonest. Thus, his naming of the Oedipus complex is a fake. If you read very closely where he's up to it, he drags in Sophocles by the tail when he is clearly talking about Hamlet. So to this day, as I always tell my students, it should be called the Hamlet complex, but Freud was very, very unhappy about Shakespeare. And then, of course, came the real outrage. I mean, it must have been as embarrassing to the cleverer disciples of the grand Sigmund Freud that he became an Oxfordian, that is to say, someone who religiously believed down to his dying day that the Earl of Oxford had written all of Shakespeare, as it would be as if he had espoused the Flat Earth Society. Total madness. And yet he took up the suggestion of that gentleman marvelously named Looney, the Looney Hypothesis, as I always call it. He took up the suggestion. It did not bother him any more than it does any other Oxfordians that the Earl of Oxford was dead before the major tragedies and the later romances had even been composed.
That's a very pedantic point, though, isn't it, Harold? The fact
very
that he
pedantic.
Was dead.
It also doesn't bother them at all that we have some of the indubitable lyrics of the Earl of Oxford, and they prove that the great man could not write his way out of a paper bag.
Yeah.
I mean, it's simply astonishing. This does not, however, all over the world at the moment. I mean, I get nasty letters from Singapore and from Australia, as well as from the United States and Great Britain, from Oxfordians denouncing me. In fact, I've said in print, and I hold by this, that the only sect quite as nasty and abusive as Oxfordians are the Scientologists. Equally pernicious types.
From my...
I recently proposed in Harper's Magazine in this country, where they tried to drag me into the Oxford controversy, I came up with a splendid idea in which I followed my late good acquaintance, the splendid novelist Anthony Burgess, in his marvelous novel about Shakespeare, Nothing Like the Sun. I went Tony one better. Tony had suggested that the Dark Lady of the Sonnets was the most notorious East Indian London whore of her time, Miss Lucy Negro. So I wrote a piece in Harper's Magazine called A Salvo for Lucy Negro, in which I explained that for some years with my graduate students, who always looked at me as though I was not exactly to be trusted, that we should not worry about so-called feminist Shakespeare or multicultural Shakespeare or Marxist Shakespeare or all these other, you know, varieties of fashionable Shakespeare, because in fact all of Shakespeare, not just the sonnets, had in fact been written by the immortal Lucy Negro. And in any case, she certainly had a much more legitimate case to be made for her than the Earl of Oxford, because she at least slept with Shakespeare.
Now, we don't know how Shakespeare became Shakespeare. Let us examine briefly how Bloom became Bloom. I hadn't realized...
Not exactly a parallel phenomenon.
Well, there are many that would dispute that, Harold, as you know. Yes. I find it astonishing that you...
All two of us.
That English was not your first language, that you're not a Nabokov, but you spoke Yiddish only
but
in your early childhood.
Only until I was 5 or 6 years old. They did not speak any English in the street or in the houses of my part of the East Bronx when I grew up between 1930 and, say, 1935 or 6. I have an odd pronunciation of English because, being a very impatient reader, I started to teach myself English when I was about 4 years old. And as George Bernard Shaw demonstrated so well in his call for a reform of the language, the way English looks on the page and the way it actually sounds, there are enormous gaps there. So I tend to sound it the way it looked to me on the page, because I'd pretty much, you know, taught myself to. And before I ever spoke it, you know, I was reading it, which is a rather odd sort of a phenomenon.
Were you brought up Orthodox?
Oh, yes, they were. My father wasn't particularly pious. He was from Odessa, where his father had been a dock worker. And he himself was a garment worker who got himself to the United States. My mother, though, was a very pious woman who came from a shtetl near Brest-Litovsk and always remained intensely religious.
How long did you remain intensely religious?
Oh, well before I was bar mitzvahed, I had already become a Gnostic heretic, one of what they would have called in ancient Hebrew the minim. I had very grave doubts about Yahweh, doubts which have only intensified in the more than half century since.
When you say you had doubts, these weren't based on Talmudic studies, but on what? On a feeling?
They were based upon my own reading of the text. It's impossible to have any ear at all for Hebrew, and I started reading Hebrew when I was a tiny child. you develop quite an ear for it. It's impossible to believe, as the Orthodox insist, that the five books of Moses could possibly be the works of Moses or of any single individual, when you can distinctly hear three or four or five narrative voices at work, one of which is very grand indeed. You know, the Yahwist himself, the J-writer, is one of the world's, you know, short of Shakespeare, one of the world's four or five great writers, up there with Chaucer and Dante and so on. So I guess I sort of doubted the veracity of the Orthodox account of the text.
You've raised the J-writer, which means a digression has to take place, to look at the book of yours, which I guess is caused you the most trouble, or got you... No, that's not right, but
it's one of the ones
it's
that
provoked the
trouble,
most sort
yes.
of intense criticism.
Yeah.
It's seen as one of the most whimsical and capricious of your books, yeah. because yeah. you argue that the J-writer is a woman.
Well, there's
the
a certain
of
amount
Solomon.
Of deliberate humour in the book, but yes, I don't say it's
You're taking the piss out of people, were you, a little?
Well, you know, if Samuel Butler could argue that the author of the Odyssey was a woman, and he did, then I felt, being a great admirer of Samuel Butler, this is the second Samuel Butler, the High Victorian, or the not-so-High Victorian, I thought it was perfectly legitimate to argue that the Yahwist was much more a high-born woman's sensibility than a male one. Certainly, the voice is a highly ironical voice and extremely skeptical of nearly all the male characters, Yahweh in particular. They all get a pretty hard time from her or whoever that author was, whereas the women characters invariably come off rather well.
Well, I thought it was a wonderful piece of intellectual mischief, at least, but I wasn't sure.
I wasn't sure either, Frank.
We discussed this on the wireless a couple of years
yes,
ago,
but I
could
that.
Never
yes.
quite see whether you were just... well, there's another great Australian expression, stirring the possum.
Stirring the possum. That's rather good. In Nigel Dennis's splendid novel, which now everyone has forgotten, called Cards of Identity, do you remember that fine book? There's a marvelous ritual that some neo-C.S. Lewis revivalists go through called easing the badger. Maybe easing the badger is another version of stirring the possum.
Well, you certainly did it very successfully. I also wondered whether or not you were seeking to goad or placate, perhaps both at the same time, your feminist critics.
Oh, I intended to infuriate them. It is, I'm afraid, true that whether they are my former students or not, and a lot of them are my former students, the feminist literary critics of the English-speaking world and Old Bloom, we are not on good terms. Most recently in England, they put me on the radio to have what was supposed to be a debate, but I wouldn't debate with her, with a lady, a fierce Lacanian. What is her name? Rose, something Rose. Rose is the last name. Jacqueline Rose, isn't it? Jacqueline Rose, yes. She got extremely exacerbated because she said I was refusing to be serious, and she was also very angry about my Shakespeare book because she said it was unforgivable to use phrases like gender and power covens. And I said, well, I thought it was very jolly to talk about gender and power covens.
But it's not only the feminists you provoke. You don't like ists or isms of almost any persuasion, do you?
Historicists, old, middle range, and new are all disasters. The sacred Ralph Waldo Emerson, whom I adore and
Waldo,
seek to emulate,
call it, don't you?
The sublime Waldo tells us many wonderful things, but one of the things he tells us is there is no history, only biography, which is a very good thing to remember. He also warns, he says, do not set out to please, you will only displease. I have taken that to heart.
I would have thought that giving the women of the world the proposition that two of the major religions are based on the writings of a woman...
Oh, three at least.
Well, okay, let's... Forgive me, I'd forgotten that one.
You mustn't forget Islam.
That three of the major religions
and
are based on...
And if you go
the...
out to Utah, there will be four.
But now you're adding sort of recent American inventions.
There are the Mormons.
Let's stick with them.
Yes.
The ones that share the same
real estate. Who may
eventually
take over this country, but never mind.
But having offered woman this remarkable prestige,
yes,
you'd think that you'd be very popular, that you would have become an icon for the feminist movement.
They took it. No, I'm afraid not. They took it that I was being sardonic.
The Marxists don't like you much either.
No. The Marxists and I loathe one another. No, I'm afraid if you name any group of ideologues, you will find another nest of my enemies.
What about those strange people in France that dissect and...
I loathe them all, and they loathe me. The followers of Foucault, the followers of Derrida,
Someone must like it. Your books sell like the clappers.
Yes, I
see. Or do they buy them to burn them?
Whacking off a series of bestsellers. But none of these people are academics, and none of these people are journalists. My British publisher for this book on Shakespeare, what's the name of that firm? The Fourth Estate people, they told my amiable agent just the other day that they were very pleased with the way the book was selling, though they said they had never published a book which had gotten such uniformly vicious reviews.
And when you were delivering a lecture, I was enchanted by this. You were delivering a lecture, you're looking out into an audience of stone faces,
yeah,
and you said it felt like you were flying in an aeroplane over a paddock full of cows.
This was at Oxford University, where they would tar and feather me if I ever come back. I gave a talk on the sacred Sir John Falstaff at Oxford University. I was at the bottom of an amphitheater. There were all these faces staring down at me. The sacred Falstaff was being very, very funny, and I thought I was being at least moderately funny about him. And I suddenly had a terrible vision as I stared at all these faces. I had a vision of cows looking up in a meadow as an airplane passed overhead. This was reported widely in the British press. Indeed, a lady friend of mine who teaches at Yale, who is a fierce Pakistani, came back from a visit home to bury her dying father to tell me that she'd got onto her first-class seat in the Pakistani airplane and found herself confronting a headline in the Times of India saying, Oxford furious at Professor Bloom of Yale, saying that the students were cows in a meadow.
That enormous chuckle of yours, which makes the couch tremble.
Thank you, my dear.
And the room, in fact, gets about 1.5 on the Richter scale.
You.
In a sense, your amiability is like a carapace. But some pain must get through. You are at once the most admired literary critic of your time and the most vilified. Aren't you hurt by it?
My dear, I am certainly enormously vilified. It is news to me that I am admired. I have an audience.
And you're being coy about that. You know you
no,
are.
No, I'm not being coy about it. I meet a lot of strangers when I walk the streets of New York City or when I go out on the road for whatever purpose. And in more than one country, I meet a lot of perfect strangers who come up to me and thank me for one book or another. And I get endless quantities of mail, which I cannot answer, from all over the world, from people who have been good enough to buy and read these books and who respond to them. But I'm delighted to tell you that these are letters from merchants, from dentists, from
you
doctors,
mean real
lawyers,
people.
Indian chiefs, everything under the sun except literary journalists and scum-of-the-earth academics.
Oh, there was a flash of anger.
No,
scum
no
of the
anger
scum
at all.
Of the earth academics.
I am on record as believing that tenure should be abolished in the English speaking world and that all the departments of English should be closed down. They can be taken over by these large networks of what calls itself cultural studies, where Batman comics and theme parks of different sorts and the antics of Madonna can be, you know, studied in minute and loving detail. But I've sort of expressed the modest hope that perhaps we could have, on the model of departments of Greek and Latin literature, so-called classics departments, perhaps we could have very nice, small, almost underground departments of literature, you know, scattered about the landscape at a few elite institutions.
Well, what about the Ray Bradbury model? in Fahrenheit 451, where isolated people keep a text alive.
Well,
do you remember the people that memorize, like
you?
I know,
that wasn't the last so far off a prophecy, except for the fact, and it is a kind of miracle to me, I have found it greatly heartening, out there in the hinterland, I got a hilarious letter from somebody who was off in the Peace Corps in the Cameroons, wherever they are. I know they are somewhere in Africa. And he protested angrily that he had been stuck in the bush for several months with a copy of my book called The Western Canon. And there was no library in sight. And he got absolutely furious at me because of the reading list at the back. I don't often answer these letters because, you know,
that's a point.
I have only so much energy, but this one was irresistible, and I wrote him back and said, well, he was sort of in the inverse position of what had originally been a marvelous short story by Evelyn Waugh, which eventually became the end of his marvelous novel, was it A Handful of Dust or Decline and Fall? I think it's A Handful of Dust. The Man Who Loved Dickens, where somebody finds himself trapped forever in the Amazon, having to read aloud the collected works of Dickens to his captor. No, there are clearly, I mean, reading is not dead in the world. I am at the moment. As you came in, I was hard at work scribbling my next opus. This is a mere opusculum. This is not a great big book, but a short book called How to Read and Why, in which, you know,
well, that'll make more money than my theoretical religion, won't it? Because that's a self-improvement book. And Americans love self-improvement.
It's definitely a self-improvement book, yes. Mm. Yes, it will try to masquerade itself as a self-improvement book.
Straight onto the bestseller list of the New York Times.
Well, it is to be hoped.
In Rackset Airport, I can see it
now. Yes, at the Rackset Airport, I have thought of already, yes. Mm. Yes.
So here's this kid in the Bronx who has taught himself English. Now, I'm no Professor Higgins, and I find American accents very difficult to locate, apart from the ones that are outrageously Bostonian or Texan or
Yeah, but I've got a sort of oddball accent because...
Well, it's not as odd as you think, because you are uncannily like Gore Vidal. When I listen to your voice, I hear Gore's voice. Your phrasing, the way... there's little dying cadences...
But Gore is American aristocrat. Wasn't Gore raised... Where was Gore raised? Was he raised in upstate New York, or was he raised in Tennessee?
Well, he's a Washingtonian. We're here in Washington Square. He was born and raised in Washington, D.C., wasn't he?
I see, where his uncle or his grandfather was a senator. One of those innumerable Senator Gores that this country has had.
Afflicted with, one might suggest.
Yes.
But how is it? Is it because you're friends? Because you are, aren't you?
Well, we're good acquaintances. I wouldn't call us really friends. We haven't seen enough of one another. We are very different people.
I just find it odd that two people from different ends of the social scale, different parts of the country. I mean, the difference, of course, is that unlike him, you're not ideological, apart from Shakespeare and great literature, and you're not as nasty.
I hope not, no. But how can one be nasty, you know, if one sinks deeply enough into Shakespeare? Shakespeare is anything but nasty. Shakespeare, almost when he's darkest, is still very funny. It's very peculiar how Iago even keeps Othello, a remarkably funny play, outrageously funny at times.
Well, in the Scottish play, for example, in the middle of all the monumental drama,
yes,
there's suddenly a Monty Python or a goon show scene, isn't there, with the porter.
The outrageous
porter. He'll snap, almost throw a bucket of water in your face.
Yes. Well, he had a great comic. He had two great comics, Shakespeare. First, he had Will Kemp, with whom he quarreled, and whom evidently he kicked out of the company. And then he had Richard Armin, A-R-M-I-N, who must have played all of the clowns and fools, and who certainly would have played the porter in the knocking at the gate scene, and who quite fascinatingly must have been the clown who brings in the snakes under a basket of figs Ah, here are the Hare Krishnas.
We must explain to the Australian listener.
Giving us a marvellous background.
The bloody Krishna are doing their number outside. I thought they died out. They used to see them in Moscow, in London, everywhere. Sydney, they were huge.
Well, one always assumes that the poor things are going to die of sheer boredom.
Well, it's a very dull lyric, isn't it?
It's really? The monotoniousness of it, as Eartha Kitt would say.
It's just the libretto lacks something.
The tune is not much, and the libretto is completely wanting.
Now, you have something in common with Shakespeare, and that is productivity. Your output is extraordinary. I'm in one of your studies, one of your many libraries, I suspect. No. And I know you've got a full-time carpenter here to adjust the bookshelving. Because there are so many damn books.
My poor wife, who is retiring as a school psychologist on the 25th of this month, she has got to catalog.
No, I'm just waving goodbye to the Krishna.
Oh, I see. My poor wife has undertaken to catalog all of one's books. There is a huge house in New Haven. Where, as she says, poor woman, she's being pushed out by the sheer weight of the books, and there are two huge Yale offices.
Women are like that. I have the same trouble with.
But she will strike back by cataloging it all, because our lawyers tell us that the whole thing, together with all papers, letters from people, and so on, has to be donated to a library in order to cut the inheritance tax.
The Bloom Memorial Library. I think this
the
is
the Bloom wonderful. Memorial Library. Thank you, my dear.
I'd like to
thank you.
I'd like to have a ticket so I could borrow
thank
from
you.
It.
Thank you. Thank you. But one isn't prolific in that sense.
Oh,
I think.
Come on, Harold. You
Shakespeare,
are
the great Shakespeare wrote or co-authored in a couple of cases 39 separate dramas ending with the two noble kinsmen. Not to mention all the sonnets, not to mention the two narrative poems and so on. I have written, this would be the 24th actual book by me, and I must have written introductions for about 800 Chelsea House volumes, and I must have introduced or provided prefaces for another couple of hundred volumes.
Harold, I don't know whose aphorism it is, but it has some truth to it, I suspect most aphorisms do. If you want something done, come to the busy person. Now, the other side of your sort of productivity is the things you don't do. Now, you don't rush out into the park and dance with the Hare Krishna. You probably don't go to many baseball matches.
No, I don't anymore, alas.
Oh, you used to
To go to Yankee Stadium a good deal, but the crowd has gotten low, they are. Doubtless very good and exuberant people, but they have gotten occasionally rather violent. And I am a slow-moving old man now, you know, soon to be 69. So I would be afraid that I would suddenly fall down those stone steps and be gone forever.
You see, I had no idea that you would have liked baseball.
Oh,
wrong
I am
me.
A fierce New York Yankee fan. How could you grow up in the old East Bronx and not be a Yankee fan? I was taken to my first game at Yankee Stadium when I was 6 years old in 1936, and there was the young left fielder, as he was then, Mr. Joseph Paul DiMaggio, recently dead, looking like a great ballet dancer out in left field.
You sound like a character from DeLillo's Underworld, grasping the sacred
Don,
baseball.
Don is a good friend. Don is a very good friend.
I think the opening of the Underworld is miraculous.
It's a wonderful. It's a wonderful book. It goes on rather a long time.
A little too long, I think.
And it sags a bit in the middle. But there are remarkable things in it.
Okay, let me take another stab in the dark. And this is I'm cheating here because I know the answer. Is it possible that you're interested in jazz?
Oh, yes, fiercely. After all, I grew up at the time when Charlie Parker and Bud Powell and Mingus and Gillespie were making their revolution. And in the summers when I was working in New York City, coming down from Cornell, 47, 48, 49, I used to go regularly with friends to Birdland, where Bud Powell and Charlie Parker would be performing. I even got to know Bud Powell, and we discussed the poetry of Hart Crane on a couple of occasions.
I remember great jazz clubs in New York. Do they still exist?
There are still very good jazz clubs, and there is a fresh generation. But I have not been to a jazz club in a couple of years, partly because they don't really get started until fairly late at night. And now that I am old, I seem to be on a bad schedule in which by about 9 o'clock at night I'm finished. And I go to sleep, and I sort of get going at about 5 the next morning. You can't go to jazz clubs on that schedule.
You handwrite, I deduce, rather than...
Written everything I have ever done with a Pentel black rolling writer ballpoint pen on a yellow legal pad on clipboards.
I've often
can't write any other way. I've never learned to type.
I've often wondered if there would have been a different outcome had Shakespeare had access to a word processor rather than a quill. Clearly, the penny aligners would have had a much better time of it, wouldn't they? Churning out text.
In the conversations of Ben Jonson with Drummond of Hawthornden, you probably remember this. Jonson, who was very close, after all, humanly, to Shakespeare, though they were rivals, but they got along very well. Jonson says to Drummond of Hawthornden, "It was the player's praise of Shakespeare. He never blotted a line." And Jonson goes on to add, very angrily, "Would he had blotted many." So obviously the two of them sat there side by side, you know, in taverns and pubs and so on, with their quills, and Jonson was laboriously doing Catiline, his conspiracy, or one of the good city comedies, and Shakespeare was racing along at top speed. We do know, because of modern scholarship, and this fascinates me, that Shakespeare, in a few cases, did substantial revision. He quite clearly greatly improved Love's Labour's Lost, because it's too good to really suit the initial date of its presentation. He quite clearly, we know for a fact, since we really have almost two versions of King Lear, so he did substantial things to Lear, and he did something... I see you watching... Is it the noise?
No. I'm overwhelmed by the religiosity of the area.
I see.
No, you're still coming over loud and clear.
He quite fascinatingly revised Othello. It fascinates me because the scholars who work on this have demonstrated that he does do things with Othello himself. He does do things with Desdemona. He does a lot to change Emilia. But he gets Iago dead right from the beginning.
And he knew him well, didn't he?
Exactly. There are no revisions whatsoever in anything Iago says. He's got Iago perfect from the start.
You call yourself Bloomstaff. What is it in the sacred Falstaff that you find so deeply attractive? Why is it that Falstaff leaps from the pages?
He is surely the most humane character in all of Shakespeare. Of the men. Rosalind is even more humane, and Cleopatra in her own wicked way is profoundly human. More profoundly human, perhaps, even than, though she seems to be a kind of sister to Falstaff in some ways. But, you know, Hamlet, very great consciousness, astonishing consciousness, but savage.
Is it his savagery that distances him from you?
Yeah, totally. I mean, he's really scary as hell. Look at him. Marvelous.
Now, the Hare Krishna are now overwhelming. I think they're just passing.
Well, they're not coming through the door in any case. So
okay.
We don't have. Oh, and right. Even if they came through, they would merely incense the air. They would be no harm to any of us.
They're as cults go, they're a reasonably amiable one.
But you know, he is superbly savage, Hamlet. Here is someone who loves absolutely no one. The Freudian notion that he's madly in love with Gertrude is, I think, taken care of magnificently by Shakespeare. I mean, there is the poor lady dying, and there is Hamlet dying, and his final words to her are, "Wretched queen, adieu," which does not seem to imply that he is overflowing with filial affection.
There's a parallel to Jesus, incidentally, who really treats the Virgin Mary almost as roughly.
Rather nastily, yes, rather nastily.
Which people forget, I think.
Yes.
You don't, because you know all the texts.
Well, it's a complex parallel. There's probably a closer parallel in a way, which Shakespeare, on some uncanny level, must be aware of. The charismatic element, they're really chanting away. The charismatic element in King David, in the so-called court historians, the fellow who writes 2 Samuel, who's probably the best writer of the Bible after the J. Ryder, there is something of the charismatic David about Hamlet. And then David is not a very gentle soul either.
Mm.
This is really quite a background.
I think they've come to anoint you.
And No. I have no Eastern beliefs whatsoever.
We live in a world where universities are under enormous attack by the Thatcherites, whatever they call themselves.
Certainly.
In the given society,
yes,
where
yes.
They believe that universities are fairly useless unless they produce knowledge that turns a quid, that makes a profit.
Okay.
In that context, I find you're soft and cuddly on other things. Your toughness on universities.
Well, mine is a selective attack. Mine is a selective attack on the universities. I don't like what I call the school of resentment. I don't like they're not feminists, you know. Feminism is an honorable social, economic, political, and cultural movement. These are feministas, as I call them, you know, pseudo-feminists. And then there are, of course, you know, what I sometimes call French Shakespeare, the Foucault gang, the new historicists. And then there are the pseudo-Marxists, who are ridiculous. I mean, there are no Marxists left in the United States except the pseudo-Marxists of the various English departments, which is hilarious. They're not Marxists. They are high bourgeois who probably go and vote for the Republicans at the same time they profess their Marxism. We are in the grip that the teaching of the humanities in the United States in particular has simply become atrocious. Because added to all this, there is that joyous bit called multiculturalism, which has now really proliferated now in perfectly mad ways, because it's also become a question of sexual orientation. I have encountered considerable nastiness in terms of letters and articles by saying, who will speak for Onan? If we are going to have transsexual studies, if we're going to have lesbian and gay studies, if we are going to have bisexual studies, why can't we have onanistic studies? It's every bit as legitimate. It is a human
sexual. Woody Allen speaks very highly of it.
I see.
Yes.
Not usually someone with whom I'm on good terms, but that's all right. Maybe we favor the same joke in this case. And then, of course, there's the utter madness of believing that just because, I can't even call it verse, I don't know whether it's verse or prose, just because it's been written by, say, an American black female or an American Mexican-American female or a Native American female of whatever sexual orientation, I'm supposed to take a story or, again, I can't call it verse. I mean, the betrayal of aesthetic and cognitive standards in the English-speaking world, because this holds in Australia and this holds in Great Britain, and it certainly does hold here in the United States, the total annihilation of all aesthetic and cognitive standards simply means that humanistic studies don't exist anymore, and these departments should simply be done away with because they are travesties. They do no good, and they do a great deal of harm.
I come to New York and I'm overwhelmed by the energy, the volume.
The Hare Krishna, yes.
Of the popular culture. Now, I wasn't actually thinking about the Krishna.
I must tell you that I've lived in this apartment for many years, and we have not had quite so vivid a manifestation or so high an auditory performance of Hare Krishna ites before this. I think they are putting this on in your honor, my dear.
The American popular culture, which of course is the world's popular culture, it dominates our country as much as it does yours, reminds me, of course, that Shakespeare was popular culture.
He still is. That is why he survives. Even though I didn't think it was a great film, I was delighted by the film Shakespeare in Love because it had just enough real Shakespeare in it, as Mr. Stoppard, I suppose.
You called it a likable travesty, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But much better Shakespeare in Love than Branagh's horrible Shakespeare films, or most of the stuff that's put on as a Shakespeare film. But Shakespeare is popular culture. Shakespeare has been popular culture in the United States from the beginning of the 19th century until now, nonstop.
Harold, I once read, and I'm sure it's accurate, that there were 500 films based on Shakespeare's text made during the silent film era alone.
My God, 500. I didn't know that.
Now, when you add to them, there'd be another 500 since.
Yes.
And then you add to them, of course, those that borrow heavily,
yes,
whether it's West Side Story
yes,
or...
Yes, of course.
Yeah. But in his own day, these remarkable plays were appreciated and enjoyed by people standing in the Globe and other theatres. They
yes,
were.
But and simultaneously, they were being appreciated and enjoyed at a rather different level by people of real intellect and discernment, at least as intelligent and discerning as we are, who had read what they were seeing in quarto editions, both authenticated and pirated, and knew the text pretty well, even as they heard it again, and were able to appreciate a variance. Shakespeare is almost unique. I sometimes think that Shakespeare, Dickens, and oddly enough, Jane Austen are going to be the only literary survivors of this visual age, which is, you know, flooding us.
Why Austen?
Because I think of an almost Shakespearean power of characterization. She hasn't got the sort of lunatic gusto of Dickens, who himself, you know, does not really have a Shakespearean power of characterization. Dickens didn't particularly like Shakespeare, interestingly enough. He liked Ben Jonson and owes a lot to Ben Jonson. He writes a comedy of humors, as Ben Jonson writes a comedy of humors, but he has heroic and annihilating energy. He has scandalous gusto,
but
as Hazlitt would have put it.
But Jane Austen...
Austen has a Shakespearean gift of characterization. The closest you can come to Rosalind in the English language after Shakespeare is Elizabeth Bennet. In Pride and Prejudice.
There's also an intense sexuality in Austen, isn't there?
There is indeed. There is indeed. Well, I'm not even so sure how sublimated it is. It's really what these people, what these young people are talking about all the time. They are finding their own ways of talking about it when they talk about who is and who is not amiable, for instance. What they really mean is who is or is not sexually appealing.
Now, run the names past me again, the survivors. The
survivors?
Yeah.
Shakespeare, certainly. Dickens, certainly. Austen, certainly. There are people, you know, who should survive, but they now need mediation. Milton utterly needs mediation, and we're not going to be able to provide mediation anymore, so I think Milton is doomed. You would have thought that Wordsworth would survive, because, after all, he invents modern poetry.
You're very fond of William Blake. You'd give him a Guernsey, wouldn't you?
Yes, but I think Blake will not survive because he is too profoundly esoteric and too difficult. Dante, who is Blake with a vengeance, cannot survive.
What about the Russians?
Well, the great Russians, yes. Tolstoy.
At least in Russia.
Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. Well, even in translation, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Turgenev, obviously, and Chekhov are going to survive. But it isn't clear to me that literacy is quite as doomed in Russia, in spite of all the travails of that unfortunate nation.
Well, the travails connect them back to their literature, of course.
Yes.
no great American writer, no Mark Twain will not survive, in your view? Melville?
The best living American writer is Cormac McCarthy, because of the astonishing book called Blood Meridian. Have you read Blood Meridian? Mm-hmm. A scandalous book. I mean, a book that the first time I read it, I couldn't believe what I was reading, which I've now taught several times, which I must have read 20 times. I'm not prepared to, you know, one would like to feel that the best living writers, who would include Philip Roth and Don DeLillo, and Cormac McCarthy and Thomas Pynchon, one would like to believe that they have survival possibilities.
Well, you're doing your best, Harold, aren't you? You really are doing your best to help good literature everywhere.
Well, one does
one's
best.
Won't be your fault.
But I don't know. It's amazing, you know, it may be that you are more on the right than I am. I mean, you have been pointing to the fact that there's an oddity in the way I'm talking. You know, I talk about someone who is under siege, but in fact, I'm just under siege by my wretched profession and by literary journalists. But in fact, I'm not under siege by mobs and mobs of students who come to me, and I'm not under siege by these hundreds of thousands of people who read me and who write me letters.
And you're not under siege by this little radio program which always enjoys having you on.
Well.
And I'm very grateful for your time.
So thank you so very much. I'm so sorry that we have had the somewhat colourful background.
You organised it, Harold. You just didn't
want
to do
this. No, my dear, no.
I'm a wake-up.
I would have thought of something more interesting as a background.